Support for the following program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional funding comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. For Black History Month, the life and music of an American legend. Join me now for a conversation with the author of a new biography about Duke Ellington. I'll talk with Mark Tucker of Columbia University. The title of his new book is Ellington, The Early Years. It's available from the University of Illinois Press. In his book, Mark Tucker explores the cultural and personal influences in Washington, D.C. and in New York City that helped to shape the early Ellington. Before we talk about Ellington's life, that is to say, the subtitle of your book, Mark Tucker, is The Early Years, just give me the basic facts and figures. Born, died, lived where, paint me a quick biographical picture.
He was born Edward Kennedy Ellington in Washington, D.C. in 1899, and he received the nickname Duke from a high school chum in Washington when he was attending Armstrong High School. And he was a pretty smart dresser, so one of his friends started calling him Duke. And he also had a bit of a royal outlook or an aristocratic bearing throughout his life, something that he inherited partly from his father, James Edward Ellington, who, although working as a caterer and a domestic servant, in fact, he worked at the White House when his son Duke was growing up. He always cultivated a kind of grand and grandiose style, both in the way he spoke and the way he dressed, and his insistence on good manners and proper bearing. So Ellington inherited these traits and, of course, carried them with him throughout his career as a public performer. And that career lasted really from the teens, from about 1917, 1918, when Ellington just got out of high school, until 1974, when he died. Mm-hmm. So it's an incredibly long and, needless to say, productive career, because this is a man who, it's estimated, wrote over 1,500 musical compositions. In fact, we're still counting. We still don't know how much music Ellington wrote. And he kept a band going for over 50 years. In fact, he even managed to keep some of the same people with him for that period of time. So he is, as you say, a musical monument. He's a musical institution, and he's regarded, I don't think anymore, not as just a celebrated figure in jazz, but as a tremendously important composer in American music, in 20th century music.
Now, would you say, for example, that he is a synthetic figure in the history of American music, or is he? Do we use a dangerous word like original and unique? You say that he was a good listener. I mean, how did he pull things together and then create what appears to be new and fresh?
I think the best artists do both. I think they tend to synthesize what has come before them, and they aim to do something original, something that has not been done by previous artists. And I think Ellington fit those criteria, certainly. He always worked with, as he said, the materials at hand. He once called himself, perhaps ironically, a primitive artist, because he was there working with the materials at hand, meaning these musicians, these great musicians like Johnny Hodges, Bubba Miley, Joseph Tricky Sam Nanton, people whose styles he knew intimately and who could produce, who both inspired him and in turn could realize the musical ideas he came up with.
Do we give Duke Ellington all the credit? How do we figure out, you know, what happened between him and these musicians that he worked with?
Yeah, we don't really know that in every case, and that's a big issue that people have argued about a lot. Namely, some of his musicians felt that he had taken undue credit for compositions that they had helped him compose, supplying maybe an idea of a melody. I'll give you an example. There's a well-known Ellington song called Don't Get Around Much Anymore. Mm-hmm. And before that piece was recorded with those words, it was called Never Know Lament. Often happened that well-known Ellington pieces first appeared as instrumentals, and then when realized they'd be popular, took on lyrics later. Now, the main idea, you probably remember Don't Get Around Much Anymore.
Sure do.
Da-ba-da-ba-ba-da. Da-ba-da-ba-ba-da. Just that little lick like that. Apparently, Johnny Hodges, the great alto saxophonist, was fooling around backstage, and that idea, that little kernel of a melody, was something that he was playing. And Ellington heard that and picked it up and extended it and eventually worked it into this piece. So that's a collaboration, but it requires at least two people. It required both of them so that, yeah, I think Hodges should get credit. I think one of the hardest things for us to do, those of us who are working on a figure like Ellington after he's gone, is to keep in mind that he juggled these various roles. He's not just a composer, even though we have his legacy now in the form of his recordings and compositions. But he's a well-rounded performer, and that was very much the kind of role, the kind of persona that he carved out early on in his career.
You mentioned, for example, that Ellington was born in Washington, D.C., and the way you organize your book, you have a section on Washington and a section on New York. What does that have to do with what we're going to hear?
Ellington spent the first 24 years of his life in Washington, D.C. He was born there, as I said, in 1899, and he left in 1923, attracted by the possibilities of New York musical activity, as so many musicians were in the 1920s. If you wanted to make a name there, still true now, really, to a large extent, you went to New York and tried your fortunes there. So that's what he did in 1923, and he went not as a band leader, but as a pianist in a band led by someone else. But very soon after arriving there in New York, he took over leadership of this band that was called the Washingtonians. And although living in Harlem, which really had the majority of the black population by this period, he was able to get a job in Midtown, in the Times Square district, where at this time, very few bands, black bands, had made inroads. It was mainly controlled by white musicians, and very difficult for blacks to get work there. However, they got a job at this club. It was called the Hollywood Cafe. Its name was changed later to the Kentucky Club. And for several years in the mid-1920s, Ellington and his Washingtonians were based there. So when we get to the story of New York and Ellington and the first recordings this band made, we have to piece together what little evidence we have. And naturally, as a music historian, I wish they had recorded more. We get a much better idea of what the band sounded like. But we can hear the band, for example, sounding like a lot of other ensembles did at the time.
Nothing particularly unique or peculiar there.
In the early period, no. Perhaps not. There are little glimpses of things to come, of sounds that we might associate later with Ellington.
All right, now what are we going to hear?
Well, let's listen to Hophead. By the way, that title refers to an opium addict. Hop was opium. I have no idea what the piece has to do with opium. I suspect very little. But it had a kind of flashy title, I suppose, if you wanted to buy a record by that name. And it is credited to both Ellington and a saxophonist from Washington days that was still with him here in New York, named Otto Hardwick, although it was usually pronounced Otto Hardwick. So here again is a collaborative piece. And you'll notice when you listen to it that it may remind you of hot jazz of the 1920s by any number of other bands, whether the California Ramblers, a white group, or perhaps Fletcher Henderson's orchestra, another well-known black orchestra. The distinctive Ellington personality is not necessarily in evidence.
Not quite.
And yet,
there.
Here's a group that clearly can play well in this style for dancing.
Okay, let's listen. Thank you.
That was Hophead, recorded by Ellington and his band in the spring of 1927. And as I said, it gives you an idea of what this band could do in a very typical way, I'd say, for that kind of mid-1920s dance ensemble. Mm-hmm. But around the same period, actually even by late 1926, we can hear some different things happening with Ellington. We can hear sounds emerging that at this time very few bands were producing in quite the same way. And we should listen a little bit to a piece that's very well known to Ellington followers, and that is the East St. Louis Tootaloo, or as some people call it, the Tootaloo.
All right.
This is a piece that was the band's theme song for many years in the 1930s, before Take the A-Train came into the picture.
All right, let's listen.
Remember, this is the 1920s, and when jazz came onto the scene, it was associated with novelty music and kind of ridiculous things, chaos, just noise for the sake of noise, and people having a good time, often in places where respectable people didn't go. But you notice in that last piece...
Just parenthetically, the history of the word jazz itself is instructive in that regard.
Yes, and in fact, it's one of the reasons, the stigma attached to jazz, one of the reasons Ellington tried to avoid the term at all costs, and preferred to say that he wasn't really a jazz musician, but he was writing, at one point he called it Negro music, and then he changed it to American music, and ultimately, I think he just wanted to be known as someone who wrote music without the labels.
So what we've just heard here is the bringing to what Ellington is doing of a kind of respectability, a kind of musicianship after a fashion.
Well, there's a lot of careful organization in East St. Louis Tootaloo, which is not necessarily unique. But there's also this quality of melancholy and this seriousness that is lacking perhaps in a lot of the peppier jazz examples that we might hear around the same time. And you heard that mournful, muted trumpet of Bubber Miley, one of his primary musicians in the band at the time. And here again, Ellington was able to take something that one of his players could do, a style of playing, and harness it to his musical vision. And that introduction, that very brooding introduction you heard, was something that you can't find on practically any other record of the period.
Do we talk here about the larger cultural influences that are helping to account for Ellington's music? What I'm leading you to here is the relationship between Ellington the musician and Ellington the black man.
Let's remember that Ellington at this point in his career was making a living as a black musician in places of entertainment, primarily in and around New York City at this time, in nightclubs, in cabarets, appearing in theaters. So he's providing music for particular function, whether accompanying dancers or accompanying musical reviews.
Or, very conscious or skits. Of his conscious of his audience.
Has to be, otherwise he'll lose his job. So he's functioning in a way that many other people were functioning, but at the same time, I think even at this early age, he's beginning to see, and he formulates this more both in music and words later on after this period, but he's beginning to see that he could be someone, a composer, who could make statements about what it was like to be a black American, to be alive and feeling things the way black Americans experience life.
Well, now at the end of his life, not at the end of his life, but toward the end of his life, Duke Ellington receives the Presidential Medal of Honor, which is certainly a distinguished and a distinguishing award. That's a retrospective kind of thing. At the time that he is writing things like or performing E. St. Louis Totolo, is this a conscious thing? I mean, is he saying, I'm black, I'm proud of it, this is what it means to be a black American? Is that what the music amounts to, or is that too much of a stretch?
That might be stretching it a bit.
Uh-huh.
I think for Ellington in 1926, 1927, East St. Louis Totolo was a new number, meaning composition. It was saying something perhaps in a way that other bands were not saying it at the time.
Uh-huh.
And later on, as I said, he would start harnessing his musical vision to themes connected with black American history. For example, in 1943, he wrote this long three-part work called Black, Brown, and Beige.
Right.
And he called it a tone parallel to the history of the Negro in America.
So he's becoming something of a historian. I mean, is that too much of a stretch?
Well, Ellington always had an avid interest in black history and,
uh-huh,
and in the contributions that black Americans have made to this society.
Tell me a little bit, Mark Tucker. Let's spend a couple of minutes talking about the man himself. Did you meet him? Did you actually talk to him? I take it that, you know, in writing this biography, you dealt with people like Mercer Ellington, his son. What was he like personally? Does that make any difference to you as his musical biographer?
First, I never had the privilege of meeting Ellington. I did hear him once in person in the early 70s. I didn't know exactly what I was hearing because I myself was not enough of a historian to realize what he was doing. I think, like a lot of other people, I associated Ellington with big band music, the music of another generation, not my own. Ellington's personality at this early period that I've been dealing with is hard to flesh out. One must go to accounts by contemporaries, to interviewers. He didn't keep a diary, for example, not that we know of, that revealed his thinking at the time about what he was doing, what he aspired to be in this period. So the further along you get in Ellington's long career, the better opportunities you have for looking at his personality. But frankly, in this study, I wasn't as interested in the personal aspects of the man as I was in his character as a musician. After all, I think we will remember Ellington first and foremost for his musical achievements, and as for his personality, I think with a lot of artists, we can consider them, we can wonder what effect they may have had on his artistic development. But unlike some other recent biographers who have been very concerned with his private life and with his activities off stage, I'm more interested, and I continue to be interested in his development as a musician.
So you're not interested here in exposing a side of Ellington that no disrespect when I say that your book has no great series of revelations about his personal life, because you don't think that that's germane to an understanding of his music in its times.
Well, I am interested in exposing Ellington as a musician, and
right,
I think that's something that hasn't been done in this period, to any great extent.
Let's listen to a third example of Ellington's music, Mark Tucker. We're talking about your biography, Ellington, the early years. Here is a piece from Creole Love Call. Why are we going to hear this? What does it tell us about Ellington's music in contrast to Hophead and East St. Louis Totolo?
Creole Love Call from the fall of 1927 represents the kind of synthetic approach, that's the word you used before, synthetic approach to composition. The first theme that you'll hear actually appeared on another record by another band several years earlier.
Hmm.
The piece was Camp Meeting Blues, recorded by King Oliver. And Ellington may have heard the recording, but he also knew that little melody because he'd just gotten a new clarinetist in the band who had been with Oliver. So this new clarinetist had carried the melody with him and played it, and Ellington said, aha, here's something I can use. That was a portion of Creole Love Call, and you heard a theme that Ellington incorporated from another record, and you heard this wordless vocal by Adelaide Hall. And again, just an example of how Ellington responded to things spontaneously and incorporated them in his music. He was playing this number on a theater tour, and a singer in the same tour was off stage, Adelaide Hall. And she heard this number, and just spontaneously, she started humming a little counter melody. And Ellington liked what he heard and said, come into the studio next day and we'll record it. And Adelaide Hall is remember saying, record what? And he said, what you just did. So that becomes a part of the composition. So you see this synthesizing approach where Ellington is taking something he got from a clarinetist, something he got from a singer, something he got from, again, his trumpeter, Bubba Miley, weaving them together and orchestrating everything, arranging what his musicians played.
Again, Mark Tucker, your book is Ellington, the Early Years. Duke Ellington died in 1974. The obvious question is not will he be remembered, but in what ways? How does his music... Do we use a dignified, large word like the legacy of Duke Ellington? Why is that important today?
I think Ellington was able, more than many other musicians of his generation and later generations, was able to sum up in music his own experiences, his own reflections and observations about living in this society. And more than that, because this is the way he tried to present himself and tried to shape himself in his career, he tried to emerge as a spokesman, really, for African Americans.
Deliberately, consciously doing this.
I think so. Both from his public statements as well as pieces he had written, like Black, Brown, and Beige, like My People in 1963, like the musical Jump for Joy, from 1941, which was recently revived in Chicago. Jump for Joy was a musical that attempted to put to rest all of the stereotypes that had previously obtained about blacks in musical theater. So we find Ellington coming back to statements about being black in this society and always stressing positive contributions and talking about the complexity of black experience.
Here's a footnote to our conversation, Mark Tucker. If he were sitting here at a third microphone, very quickly, tell me, what would you say to him? What would you ask him?
If Ellington were here, I would ask him about taking us back to the old days, asking particularly about memories of growing up in Washington. Because one of the things that I discovered in doing this project is that there was a lot more in the early Washington years than I had previously thought. There are no recordings that Ellington made when he was growing up, but in his memoirs, Music Is My Mistress, he talks about all of these interesting musicians, people he learned from, his teacher Henry Grant, who was a concert pianist and taught him harmony, ragtime pianists who also had conservatory training, people with colorful names like Sticky Mac and the Man with a Million Fingers. So I would try to get Ellington to reminisce about. I heard on different occasions that he did this. I would not attempt to talk to Ellington about musical issues. For example, why did you write this piece in this way?
He did it. It's there.
He had no time, really, for talking shop about music. A lot of musicians, particularly jazz musicians, don't particularly enjoy that aspect of shop talk. But I think Ellington could be coaxed into revealing more about his early past than we've heard so far.
Well, Mark, I want to thank you for your contribution to Soundings. Mark Tucker, the author of Ellington, The Early Years, the University of Illinois Press. I'm glad to have you at the Humanities Center this year, and I wish you well. And you're working now on a project about Duke Ellington's compositional process. Good luck with that.
Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. You've been listening to a conversation with Mark Tucker, whose new book is Ellington, The Early Years, published by the University of Illinois Press. Mark Tucker teaches at Columbia University. If you'd like a cassette copy of this program, send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 592. That's program number 592, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete listing of Soundings discussions available on cassettes. The National Humanities Center welcomes your comments. Next week, part two of Soundings for Black History Month. The topics will be multiculturalism and American education. I'll talk with scholars from Michigan State University and the Johns Hopkins University, and you'll hear commentary from the Director of Secondary Education Programs at the National Humanities Center. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Please join me again next week at this time on this radio station. Until then, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center.
Partial support for this program comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
The musical legend Duke Ellington, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for a conversation with Mark Tucker of Columbia University, the author of a new biography of Duke Ellington. What shaped Ellington and his music? Contrary to popular opinion, he didn't spring fully formed onto the stage of the Apollo Theater. The Life and Music of Duke Ellington, the first segment in a series of programs for Black History Month, this week on Soundings.